Support for Faith Matters comes from the law offices of Mullen, Hoard, and Brown, LLP, offering a full range of legal services to regional and national clients. Mullen, Hoard, and Brown are members of ALFA International. More information is available at 765-7491 or mullenhoard.com.
Welcome to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, celebrating 100 years of faith and healing for Eastern New Mexico and West Texas. Covenant Health's mission continues to be ministry through healing by caring for the whole person, body, mind, and spirit. Now here's your host, Tom McGovern.
I'm Tom McGovern, host of Faith Matters, and it's my delight this Sunday afternoon to have as our special guest, Jack Sacco. Jack is visiting us from Birmingham, Alabama. Jack, it's a delight to have you in Lubbock, and welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
During your visit to Lubbock, I was fortunate to hear your talk to the students and at the university. Very, very touching, riveting. Jack, tell us a little about yourself.
Okay, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, went to Catholic schools there, and went to the University of Notre Dame, which I loved, being an Irish.
One of the fighting Irish.
One of the fighting Irish from Notre Dame, and I loved it. And most of my friends went to Alabama or Auburn or someplace like that, but I escaped Alabama and loved going up north and meeting people from all over the world up at Notre Dame. Graduated with a degree in aerospace and mechanical engineering. Worked as an engineer for several years, and then I sort of changed majors at some point. And I actually went to work as a producer for a nun named Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica, the sister who started the radio station and the
television, right?
Oh, how fascinating.
I worked there as a producer. At the time, they just had their headquarters in Birmingham, Alabama. I went to work there as a producer, and I had no experience as a producer. I learned how to produce television, film. A lot of people sometimes will ask me, what was it like to work for Mother Angelica? You know, I say, well, the good news is I don't have to go to purgatory now.
How kind of you.
How kind of me. So it was an incredible, incredible experience. I met so many, you know, fantastic people from all over the place. But I worked there for several years. And then I did go out to Los Angeles and started working as a writer and a producer. Wrote several things and helped produce several independent features. Then the idea came up of writing a book about my father, which I did.
You mentioned that you knew Loretta Young.
I had met her through one of the productions that I had done. Even though she was in her late 70s when I met her, and I was probably in my early 30s, we became very close friends. And she was one of these incredibly down-to-earth, humble, but beautifully elegant women. And she also became friends with my parents. And she loved my father, and she loved my mother. And my mother would bake her cookies, and real family relationship. And she mentored me in a great respect. She introduced me to her friends in Hollywood, which are people like Jimmy Stewart, and on and on and on. And
so all part of a very rich experience for you. And
it was. It was a remarkable experience to get to know her and sort of that golden age of Hollywood and people there.
You told a fascinating story about how your grandfather finished up in Birmingham, like he came through New York. Tell us a little about what happened to him in Chicago, which was one of his stays before he found a permanent home in Birmingham.
All of my grandparents really came from Sicily, but my grandfathers had come over. They went through Ellis Island, made their way to Chicago because they had friends and relatives there. One of my grandfather's friends was a notorious little fella who was not wealthy at all in Sicily. He was just a little kid in Sicily. In America, he was wealthy. He had money. He had a restaurant. And my grandfather came to find out that this guy worked for Al Capone. And he wanted my grandfather to join up, like, come with us. You'll make a lot of money. My grandfather said, you know, I don't think I want to get involved in this. This particular guy, my grandfather's friend, ended up being one of the shooters in the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Al Capone's guys came to my grandfather and said, you know, you have a wife, you know, you have a family and you have this. You need to pay us protection money. Pay us some tax, and then we will make sure that nobody harms you or your wife or your children. My grandfather said, I'm not going to do that. Long story short, he had a shootout with Al Capone's guys.
He had to leave town.
He left town. Yeah, he thought that was the best thing to do. Let's just get out of here. So they left town. They went to a place where they thought there would be no mafia, which was Alabama. And sure enough, there was no mafia. There was no mafia in Alabama.
So that was your association with Alabama then?
So that's how the whole family ended up down there. That's where my father was born. Then that's where I was born.
And your dad grew up where in?
He grew up in Alabama. He spent some of his youth in Chicago, but he grew up in Alabama.
This was so poignant that the first beach your dad ever saw was Omaha Beach as a young soldier.
That's right. He was 18 years old when he got the notice, his draft notice, and he had just finished high school, was working on the family farm in Birmingham, Alabama, which is, the farm was right where the airport is now. He went off to war. They had never taken vacations or anything like that. And so the first time my father was away from home was to go off to training. And then the first beach he ever saw was Omaha Beach.
Let's pick up his story as you recounted in the book. Tell our listeners about how you came to write the book. Tell us about your dad, how he didn't speak about the war at all. But then when you were 12 years old, you had a very, very important conversation with him.
He would tell me things that happened before that. He had medals and awards and swords and things like that. And so he would tell me some of the fun aspects of the war, you know, like the buddies and the jokes and the pranks they would play on each other. And he had gotten to be around General Patton a lot, you know, was there when Patton gave the big speech. At the beginning of the Patton, George C. Scott gives a speech. Well, my father was there when Patton actually gave that speech.
Before the big American flag.
Before the big American flag. Yeah, my father was there when that speech was actually given, which was just outside of Oxford, England, the day before D-Day. So he would recount those types of things to me. When I was 12, he asked me to sit down and he said, I want to show you something that happened during the war. And as a kid, I thought, this is going to be fun. Oh, another fun story. And he said, I'm going to show you something that happened at a concentration camp. I said, what's a concentration camp? I was 12. I didn't know. And he said, the Nazis were killing people there. We made them stop.
And that was the beginning of the narrative from your dad, which you recount in the book, Where the Birds Never Sing. Jack, we'll take a short break now, and then we will continue with the story of your father and what transpired during the war.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health. Since 1918, Covenant has brought together world-class physicians, nurses, and professionals whose sacred mission is compassionate care for every patient. And as Lubbock's most awarded hospital for high-quality patient care, you know you're in caring hands. For more information and to see our 100 years of medical milestones, visit covenant100.org.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Here again is your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. It's our delight this Sunday afternoon to have as our special guest Jack Sacco. Jack is author of the book, Where the Birds Never Sing. It's a true story of the 82nd Signal Battalion and the liberation of Dachau. Tell our listeners about Where the Birds Never Sing.
I called my father and told him about when I was writing the book. I said, I heard that there's a legend. I've been to Dachau and I noticed it was just completely quiet. And I said, I heard that there's a legend that the birds never sing there. My father's response was, after what I saw there, after what I witnessed there, I don't blame him.
Jack, when we took our short break, we had placed your dad in the army, Patton's real presence, just before D-Day, then Omaha Beach, the first beach he ever saw. How did you remember Omaha Beach?
He would tell me there was a great deal of trepidation. After they heard General Patton speak that day, they were ready to fight. They were ready to win the war, and they felt invincible. As their boat approached Omaha Beach and they saw it come into view, they were frightened. My father's grandfather had given him a crucifix before he left, told him in Italian, Giuseppe, Joe, God will protect you. hold on to this cross. Throughout the war, there were certain times, and as they approached Omaha Beach was one of those times where he held that cross and prayed. He would always say, I was 19 when we landed on the beach, and I felt like by the time we got to the top of the cliffs, I was 35. It became real.
A baptism of fire and of death and destruction, my goodness.
He was in the Signal Battalion. The Signal Battalion was in charge of communications. They would string phone lines from the front lines, from where the infantry was, all the way back to wherever the generals were. A lot of people don't realize the front lines of a battle change constantly. It might be the front lines one day, and you might be behind enemy lines the next day, being at the same spot. The Germans just a lot of times would come in and cut the lines or steal the phone lines. My father and his buddies would have to put them back up and this type of thing. But they had to make sure that there were communications. Everybody in the war knew what was going on and that the generals and the people and the commanders could communicate with the infantry.
Tell our listeners about being up in the trees and they could see the enemy lines and Patton drove up.
It was an instance where the guys were up in trees, up above the infantry. And the infantry guys were telling them, you need to get down because you give away our position. We're at the front. We know that the Germans are close by. They're going to know where we are. My father and his buddies were telling the guys down on the ground, the infantrymen, this is our job. We're supposed to put up these phone lines and this is our job. So one day they were up there and they saw a Jeep come flying up to the front, just slammed on its brakes and skidded to a stop and just below the trees. And General Patton jumped out of the Jeep, looked up into the trees and said, soldiers, what are you doing up there? My father and his buddies were looking down and one of the soldiers said, sir, we're up here, we're putting up the phone lines. And Patton said, let me ask you a question, soldier. From where you are, up in that tree, can you see the enemy? And the guy in the next tree over from my father said, yes, sir, I can see the Germans. They're right over there. I can see them from where I am. They're maneuvering and they're getting in place. And Patton said, don't they make you nervous? The American soldier said, no, sir, they don't make me nervous, but you do.
So then the Battle of the Bulge. Take us to the, as your dad remembers, the eve of entering Dachau.
Toward the end of the war, they started seeing more and more, and this was in mid-April of 1945 now, because they had gone through the Battle of the Bulge, they had gone through Christmas and New Year's and all that. So they actually had stayed in France for several months after the Battle of the Bulge, and now they were going through Germany, and they were just going through it at a fast pace, like 100 miles a day or something, advancing. And toward the middle of March or so, Germans were surrendering by the thousands. On the evening of April 28th, which was a Saturday evening, they normally would have kept going, but the captains and the company commanders said, we're going to bivouac here for the night. And then tomorrow, the concentration camp of Dachau will be in our zone of action. And we are to go in, we are to secure the camp, we are to wait for the doctors to come in there. They waited, instead of going in at night, which they would have done if it had been anyplace else, they waited until the next morning, which was Sunday, April 29th, 1945. Then they got the command, let's go in. They stormed the camp.
Without resistance, they took the camp then.
He told me that the gun battle at the camp only took about 20 minutes. The regular Nazi soldiers had left. They had evacuated, but the SS troopers were there. The SS troopers were there to kill everybody. No witnesses, no memory. My father and his buddies didn't know what it was when they approached Dachau. They just heard the name, which was the name of the city. It was the name of the little town. They didn't know what that was. They just knew it was a prison of some sort. As my father said, he and his buddy said, this place is big, giant, whatever it is. But the infantry took it over within 20 minutes. Some of the infantrymen had jumped over the walls, and so then they opened the gates.
And then your dad describes in the book, through your words, share with us his first impression when they arrived there.
This is when he showed me those photographs when I was a kid. And he said that when they first walked through the gates, they could smell this really horrific smell. And they even joked with the infantry, you took this place easy. Man, you did some work here. And instead of being happy, the infantry just looked down and they were just somber. One of my father's buddies said, what is this place anyway? The infantrymen said, welcome to hell. Then my father looked around and saw the devastation. He said it was very, very quiet, but there were thousands of bodies everywhere he looked. I describe it in detail in the book, but I'll read an excerpt from the book. The prisoners had apparently not understood what had happened during the first 30 minutes or so after we took over the camp. Now they were beginning to realize that we were the good guys and that they had been liberated. Some of them began yelling and shouting. The cheers of the few soon grew to become a deafening roar throughout the camp. "These are the ones we save," I thought, as chills ran through my body. They were crowding together, reaching through the fences, wanting to touch us. They looked like the walking dead, like they were too frail to stand or reach or even smile. Yet in their parched voices, we heard jubilation, and in their sunken eyes, we saw the joyful glimmers of resurrected hope. They were laughing, crying, singing, holding their arms high in the air, embracing each other, while looking at us in disbelief, almost unable to grasp that their day of liberation, their exodus, was at hand. Just then, as if on some celestial cue, the sun broke through the clouds, sending shafts of light and color over the entire camp. Darkness had been defeated by light, and the prisoners, squinting into that brilliance, reached out to us and wept tears of joy. Their agony was over, but for us, the liberators, our journey into this deepest part of hell was just beginning.
Jack, we'll take a short break now, and then we will continue with the story as your dad remembers Dachau.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health. Since 1918, Covenant has brought together world-class physicians, nurses, and professionals whose sacred mission is compassionate care for every patient. And as Lubbock's most awarded hospital for high-quality patient care, you know you're in caring hands. For more information and to see our 100 years of medical milestones, visit covenant100.org. The views, opinions, and comments that are expressed on this program are solely those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect or represent the views and opinions of KTTZ-FM, Texas Tech Public Media, Texas Tech University, Texas Tech University System, or our faculty and staff, our affiliates, our partners, and our sponsors.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Here again is your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm your host, Tom McGovern, and this Sunday afternoon, to the voice of our guest, Jack Sacco, recounting his dad's, Joe Sacco's, experience of the liberation of Dachau, captured in the book which Jack has written, Where the Birds Never Sing, the narrative of a terrible time we should never forget. Jack, as your dad captured and remembered the riveting details of his earliest experiences of that time in Dachau, when he found in one of the railroad cars a mother and child. Remember that for us.
He climbed up to the top of one of the rail cars in which people had been starved and they were dead. They were looking down into the rail cars to see if anybody was alive. And as my father was looking into one of them, he noticed in the corner a lady. He said she was probably in her early 20s, leaned up against the corner, nursing a baby. Both of them were dead. Being raised Italian Catholic, he saw Madonna and Child, a symbol of life, hope, and the future. He said that he knew that in his mind, he felt like she was trying to give her last drop of life to this baby so that he could live. And he was thinking she was telling the baby even, hold on until the Americans get here. Try to live. They had both died. He told me, he said he knew that at that moment, he would never see anything more tragic than that. He started weeping. You have to remember, my father and his buddies had been at Omaha Beach. They had been through the Battle of the Bulge. They had seen entire cities blown up, destroyed all around them. Friends die in their arms, and they'd been through this for a year. Now, when he walked into Dachau, it touched him in a deep and profound way, and he would never see anything more tragic than this. He started crying. He said his friend came to console him, and he kept trying to talk to his friend about this lady. He held on to that cross that his grandfather had given him, and he prayed to God. He asked God to forgive him for not getting there sooner, for not getting there a day earlier, an hour earlier. Maybe he could have saved that baby. Maybe he could have saved that lady.
In addition to carrying the crucifix, he also carried something for his buddy Silverman.
Silverman, who was a jeweler, but he was a small little guy. And my father was a big, muscular, strong guy. And Silverman had given my father a little box of jewelry, which included an engagement ring for Silverman's girlfriend and a necklace and a couple of things like that. He told my father, "You hold on to this because we're both going to make it through the war." My father said, "Well, you hold on to it. I don't want to carry your stuff around." And he said, "No, because you're a big, strong guy. Nobody's going to mess with you. Some of these guys might try to steal this stuff from me." And my father said, "I'll hold on to it." And my father kept it, held on to it all through the war. Silverman was Jewish, and Silverman, unfortunately, was killed in combat about a week or two before they got to Dachau. The heartbreak of one of my father's closest friends dying. And also, he wondered, what would Silverman think of this place? It was an incredible emotions that went through all of them.
And of course, then, you know, the poignancy, finding the dead children, the shoes in the concentration camp.
There were children who had been executed. Some of the Nazis had used teenagers as target practice, would get them to run across a ramp and use them as target practice. You know, if they made it all the way to the end, which was uncommon, then you go back to the beginning and start over.
And then, of course, the awful experience of finding the infirmary where these inhumane
experiments by Joseph Mengele. It was something that was so awful that my father and his buddies, once again, having been through every major battle in the World War II, they had never seen anything. They never thought anything like this could possibly ever exist. They never thought people could do this to other innocent people, young people, babies, children, old people, the infirmed, women.
In your dad's name, in your dad's memory, what would your hope be from the recounting of Dachau and from the book you wrote?
When my father told me about this when I was 12, he said, "I want to show you this for two reasons. One is that I want you to know that this did happen. People will try to tell you it didn't happen. The Holocaust happened. I was there. I saw it. It happened." Just for the record, the Holocaust ended the minute the American soldiers walked in that gate. That's when it ended. But he also told me, he said, "Never let this happen again." I was 12 at the time, and I wondered, how could I stop something like this from happening? It took the entire might of the American army to stop this. But I realize now what he was talking about is, look at the signs of the times. When people start marginalizing other people, for whatever reason, notice that they never marginalize themselves. They always marginalize somebody else. When you start doing that and say, these people don't deserve to live, or these people don't deserve to be around the rest of us, they don't need to have their voice heard.
Which you have so beautifully and tragically, but beautifully captured in the book, that voice needs to ring clear today as ever before.
Today, more than ever.
Jack, from the book, there's another excerpt that I would like you to share with our listeners.
I'd be happy to. When they left Dachau the next morning, they stayed overnight, and then they left the next morning, and doctors and nurses and other troops came in, and my father was with the infantry, so they kept going. But here's an excerpt from the book. "We left Dachau later that morning, having assisted the relief organizations in their efforts to bring some semblance of humanity back to this place that had endured so much tragedy and sorrow. Our hearts were burdened by what we had seen, but somehow lifted by the passionate gratitude of the liberated, who had blessed us with their joy, rewarded us with unexpected insights into what we had achieved. Now, after a year of combat, each of us finally and forever understood why destiny had called us to travel so far from the land of our birth and to fight for people we did not know. And so it was here, in this place abandoned by God and accursed by men, that we came to discover the meaning of our mission."
Jack, you've honored us this Sunday afternoon by remembering with us of the place where the birds never sing, but at the same time bringing us hope in this challenge to be truly human, not to marginalize, not to reduce any group to us and them, so that we can live in harmony, not necessarily in unity, but in harmony, in respect as God's children. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You've been listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Tom McGovern. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, celebrating 100 years of working to improve the health and quality of life in the communities we serve. Join us next Sunday for another edition of Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1, a service of Texas Tech Public Media.